Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, we have a very special treat in store today. Two of my personal heroes are with us virtually, both distinguished men of military distinction, Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marine Corps retired, a force reconnaissance Marine before taking up his job leading what we call the Special Forces in the War of Ideas at the Center for Security Policy. Our other guest is Command Sergeant Major, United States Army retired, and I can't say enough about him, Michael Mabee. He is a volunteer with our Secure the Grid Coalition. He has put the work of that coalition and so much more up in lights, among other places, at 60 Minutes. He is the author of the Civil Defense book and just an incredibly inspiring individual for all of us at the Center for Security Policy and the Secure the Grid Coalition. We're proud to sponsor. Gentlemen, I am really pleased to have you both here to talk about a specific mission that you have set for yourselves and that we need the help of the American people with. And I want to just say, first of all, welcome aboard. It's good to have you both with us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
So, Tommy, you have worked with the center actually for quite a number of years, most of it before you took on the present job of running the shop, as the guy who was running efforts to secure the grid. You have made a point of reminding me that early on in that time, I had encouraged you to take a hard look at Texas as a place where we might actually make a difference. Mike maybe has moved there from up in the northeast part of the United States, and you two have teamed up to try to get something really important done, both for the people of Texas, whose grid they would like secured for sure. Tell us a little bit about what's afoot, the need, and the dangers, for that matter.
Sure. Yeah, Frank, well, I'll just start by rewinding the clock about 10 years, actually, right about this time, in fact, 10 years ago, when I'll never forget you sitting me down and talking about the threat of electromagnetic pulse, for example, and asking me to take over this nationwide Secure the Grid Coalition, which has been a privilege to run for those many years. And saying, look, Texas has its own grid. You're going to focus there first. And we have a lot of pretty awesome, miraculous stories about how we've made progress in Texas. But we haven't made enough just yet. And so along the way, Mike has not only been a resident of Texas and certainly will have something to say about the ERCOT grid and the consequences of when it went down, but he is also illustrative of the type of volunteers that we have in the Secure the Grid Coalition. And I think preeminent among those volunteers, because he is the man who's tracking so many things that the federal government should be tracking, that they should be attending to. These things are being done by a volunteer patriot, retired Command Sergeant Major. So thank you, Frank, for giving me the opportunity to run that coalition, for giving us the charter 10 years ago to focus on Texas. Thankfully, we do have some good stories to tell, but I think we ought to probably start with Mike explaining how he got into this and what it was like in Texas when the lights went out.
Yeah, so I first became interested over a decade ago in the security of the electric grid, and as it just so happened, I was in New York City during 9/11 when all of Lower Manhattan went out after that disaster and the Great Northeast Blackout of 2003. My office happened to be in New York City when that happened. I ended up moving out of New York into Connecticut just in time for the 2011 ice storm, which wiped out Connecticut's grid. And at that point, I really started researching, why does this happen? Why do blackouts happen? And I realized that the federal government has known for decades about various threats to the electric grid, not just weather. I mean, we all kind of know about weather. Probably everybody's listening at one point or another has experienced a weather-related blackout. So that's something people are familiar with. But what a lot of people don't know is that the federal government has known since 1981 about the threat of a physical attack against the electric grid. And the federal government has known since at least 2003 about the cyber threats, including China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. Yeah, we've known about these threats for decades, and literally nothing has been done. So in addition to, the extreme weather threat, which, we're seeing more and more, and we'll talk about, with Texas shortly, we've got the threats of a physical attack against the electric grid, which we've recently seen all over the country. And unbeknownst to most Americans, because this data is not very readily available, 44% of the electric disturbance events in the United States in the last decade have been due to physical attacks against the electric grid. About 48% of them are due to weather, as you would kind of expect. But it was shocked me when I first realized, when I started pulling all this data from the federal government and putting it in a way that the public could understand, that 44% of the disturbance offense are physical attacks against the electric grid. And Mike, when
you talk about that, you're talking, I suppose, mostly about localized attacks rather than the kind that might take down large sections of the grid, for example, that of Texas. But you also lived through a physical storm that very nearly brought that whole ERCOT system to a screeching halt.
And let's go to that. So Storm Uri in February of 2021, and we saw it coming. We knew a week ahead of time ERCOT was issuing alerts. And as soon as the cold weather hit Texas, the Texas grid capitulated. And as a result of that, we had 250 people dead, mostly of carbon monoxide poisoning, exposure, failure of home medical equipment, all things tied directly to the loss of the electric grid, and then over $60 billion in economic damages, probably more than that. I think that's the low-end estimate. It was not the first time that happened in Texas. In 2011, the exact same thing happened. In 1989, the exact same thing happened. Now, luckily in Texas, the third time they took some actions, which we can't say for the federal government, when it comes to the entire United States electric grid, very little action has been taken on any of these threats. But in Texas, after the 2021 blackout, the legislature did take some actions to get weatherization standards in place and also to protect against some of the cyber threat. There's still a lot more work to be done, but Texas actually is leading the country in terms of taking any action whatsoever to protect their electric grid. So they are to be absolutely commended for that.
And again, this goes back to what Tommy was talking about a moment ago. They have the advantage of having most of the state covered by their own grid. They're not relying upon, their piece of the eastern or the western, basically divided by the Rocky Mountains sectors of the grid. So just to come back to you, Tommy, there is an effort afoot, despite this progress, despite really the validation of Texas being able to do something because they've got this kind of, control over the grid. An effort is afoot to take that away from them. We'll have to take a short break here in just 30 seconds, but tee it up if you would very quickly.
Sure. Yeah, Frank, it'll be important for us to explore exactly what's happening. But yeah, 14 February, Valentine's Day, the anniversary of Winter Storm Uri, Congressman Greg Cesar from Texas announced this Connect the Grid Act. And it's supposed to help Texas in the event of another storm or a blackout. It will do nothing of the sort. And for the reasons we'll explain shortly, it could be extremely detrimental to the state of Texas.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to have to come back to why and what it means for the rest of us as well. Tommy Waller and Mike Mabey are in the house. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, President Biden and Secretary of State Tony Blinken threatened that if Israel does not change its operations in Gaza, U.S. policy towards supporting the Jewish state will change. Translation, unless Benjamin Netanyahu's government saves Hamas, America will no longer supply the weapons required to defeat it. The Biden administration is also reportedly conducting a four-pronged campaign to overthrow the Israeli government. What is now in distinct prospect is an American-driven defeat of an allied nation that will make Team Biden's betrayal and destruction of Afghanistan pale by comparison. While the Israelis are hoping to secure further U.S. help with expanded humanitarian assistance that principally props up Hamas, their enemies and ours now foresee that they will surely be able eventually, if not soon, to drive the Jews from the river to the sea. Biden's Afghanistan 2.0 must be repudiated now. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're talking to two of my personal heroes, Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marines, retired. We're also talking to Command Sergeant Major, one of the senior most members of the enlisted ranks in the United States Army, now retired as well, Mike Mabee. Gentlemen, you earned my great admiration for your tireless efforts, both in uniform to protect our country and also having taken the uniform off to continue doing that with respect to the most critical of our critical infrastructures. And Colonel Waller, you were just about to tell us a little bit about an effort that's underway now to ostensibly to try to help the people of Texas by tying them in more thoroughly to the rest of the nation's grids, but that may not actually have the desired effect at all. Walk us through it, sir.
That's right. Yeah, Frank, this Connect the Grid Act that was filed and announced on Valentine's Day of this year, supposedly to help Texas in the event of another, you know, winter storm, it's not at all the case. What that bill would do ultimately is it would force Texas to become subservient to the federal government when it comes to rules and regulations governing the grid in Texas. Right now, the state of Texas has the ability to screw things up faster or fix things faster than anywhere else in the country, which is of course why you sent us there years ago to make it a priority. And as Mike just mentioned, they actually took the steps to fix it much faster than anywhere else in the country in the wake of Winter Storm Uri. And so, Frank, one of the things I'd like to do is just to highlight a report that we generated. And a lot of this is due to Mike's exceptional research over the past decade in the rulemaking process that the federal government uses to create standards for protecting the grid and just how onerous it is. And so what I'd like to do is let the viewers know that this report, it's titled Five Reasons Why a Federal Takeover of the Texas Electric Grid Will Hurt Resilience. I want to ask Mike to talk a little bit about some of those reasons, starting with this onerous process by which the federal government makes its rule.
Right. And I can give you one really good example. After the Great Northeast Blackout of 2003, in which 55 million people were without power, the root cause of it really was foliage in Ohio contacting some transmission lines and causing a cascading blackout. It took, so right, you know, after the blackout, congressional hearings, and they decided we need a tree trimming standard. It's called vegetation management standard. It took the federal government 10 years. It was 2013 before the final standard was in place. Is it effective? Well, let's ask the people formerly of Paradise, California, where PG&E's equipment, you know, caused those wildfires from lack of vegetation management. So the bottom line is the federal government, number one, is onerous and slow to even get standards in. And when the standards come in, they're written by the industry itself, not by the government. They're written by the utilities themselves. So these standards—
So this is a classic example of regulatory capture, I guess, would you say?
Absolutely. I like to say the tail wagging the regulatory dog. And Texas has the opportunity, because it has its own grid, to protect its own grid, which the federal government has failed to do. Now, if the federal government was efficient, and if we had a secure grid, I would say, great, yes, it might be benefit, you know, to Texas to join it. But that is not the case. Texas has a better chance.
Sounds kind of like the border, now that I think about it, yeah. Mike. If the government's not defending it, Texas better do its own thing, right?
Yeah, and, you know, as with the grid, you know, I think Texas has already shown it is better suited to protect its own grid than the federal government is. Mm-hmm. So
now,
I don't
just
think
to be clear, both of you have made the point, but I do want to emphasize there's a lot that we've been trying to do with the state of Texas, and I want to do a special shout out to Senator Bob Hall of East Texas. He has been single-handedly trying to work this problem for, I think, four different sessions and deserves a lot of credit. He'll be the first to say there's a lot of work to be done. But the point is they've got the flexibility to get that work done if they put their minds to it. And Mike, you've done more than anybody I know to challenge the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the captured regulatory body that's supposed to be overseeing this whole thing. We had an amazing experience not too long ago. Tommy Waller was up on stage in the Capitol amphitheater, where a wonderful film that you guys have had a very important hand in putting together with our friend David Tice, Grid Down, Power Up. In fact, Dennis Quaid was on the stage with you when this was presented on the Hill. And, you know, out of the crowd came Neil Chatterjee, the former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to basically applaud the work that you guys are doing. And let me just say, ladies and gentlemen, this is a classic story of the kind of contributions that I believe our Center for Security Policy is making to the fight day in and day out. I used to do it. Tommy Waller's now leading the charge. I hope you'll take a look at the work there at centerforsecuritypolicy.org and make a contribution to enable this work to carry on. It supports, among other things, the volunteers that Tommy helps lead with the Secure the Grid Coalition. Mike may be one of the preeminent ones of them. So finish your thought here, Command Sergeant Major. This is such an important story. How does it tie into what we want people also to do with respect to ERCOT?
Right. Well, and, you know, I think in Texas, you know, one of the challenges that we are going to have is the same challenge on the federal side, which is the industry lobbyists and the industry money, which constantly tries to fight against any type of regulation. And I'm not one who's for a lot of regulation, but when it comes to our critical infrastructure, we absolutely have to secure it. And that's going to require, you know, prudent regulation, and it's going to require politicians to stand up to the pressures of industry and their, you know, political donation and lobbying and do the right thing for the people of Texas.
Yeah. And Tommy, how big a problem is that? I think you've experienced it firsthand in the Texas legislature, among other places. Sure.
Yeah, the utility lobby is extremely powerful, Frank. And if they want something to pass, it'll pass. If they don't, it won't. That's just the bottom line. And here's the thing, though, and you know, Mike will say the same. There's nothing that either of us ever did in uniform that would actually make a difference in the day-to-day survival of the American people. Those who keep the lights on, those who operate the grid and are working to protect it, we owe our own survival to them. So I don't want to be hostile to the industry. In fact, we can be the industry's best friend, because the good news is this is a fixable problem. All these hazards actually have solutions that will fix them. And so it's not a situation that can't be fixed. It's going to cost money. And our raising awareness is just one way for the utility industry to get cost recovery to fix those problems. And thankfully, that's exactly what Texas did. In this report, people can see at the very end, the six things that Texas did right after Winter Storm Uri, where they created financial incentives for the utilities to protect against cold weather. And they created very, very steep penalties, $1 million a day for failure to do that. And so what we've argued in this report is that Texas needs to take the same exact approach and address the different threats that the federal government has failed. And all the evidence to show that failure is here in the report, available, again, like Frank mentioned, centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Click on infrastructure security and you'll see the steps. There's an option, that's actually an option where people can take action to get involved in the movement to have Texas protect its grid.
Yeah, and that report is available for free there, of course, digitally. But Mike, maybe let me conclude with you. How important is it for people to take action along the lines of what's recommended there at CenterForSecurityPolicy.org and SecureTheGridCoalition.com? Yeah,
the lives of their families depend on it, is the bottom line. We cannot survive without the electric grid. It is the life support system of 330 million people in the United States. If, you know, people need to take action if they don't want their families to, you know, possibly become victims of a failure to act.
Okay. And finally, Tommy, where do they go to act again?
Sure. Yeah. CenterForSecurityPolicy.org. Click on infrastructure security and you can see everything we're doing in that space. And you'll see the spot that says take action to protect the Texas electric grid.
And do it, folks. Take action. We need it now. Our friend Steve Bennett says action, action, action. We'll settle for action, action. Let's just get it done right away. Tommy and Mike, thank you so much for your leadership on this. Come back to us with updates, if you will, very soon. We'll be right back with more, folks, right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to welcome, once again, one of our favorite guests. His name is Tyler O'Neill. He's a favorite guest, among other reasons, because he is one wickedly smart guy. He is the guy who makes the trains run as the managing editor of the Daily Signal, a really important publication of the Heritage Foundation. But what makes him a special person of admiration for me and appreciation is the work that he's done over the years on an outfit that has, well, among other things, vilified me, but a great many good people, called the Southern Poverty Law Center. And he wrote a book on the subject entitled Un-American, which is certainly apt. It's, that's not quite right. No, I'm looking at the title of your article.
It is Un-American.
Well, it is.
The article is, yeah.
he wrote an important book on making hate pay, which is all about the corruption at the SPLC, as it's known almost universally. It's great to have you back, Tyler, and thank you, because in the Daily Signal recently, you wrote an important piece citing a mutual friend of ours, I think Michael Farris, a great, you know, attorney and civil rights champion, freedom fighter, really. About his characterization of what the SPLC is up to. And I'd like you to share it with our audience, if you would.
Yeah. Real salt of the earth guy, too. I mean, you wouldn't know. If you were sitting down with Mike Farris to talk about anything, you wouldn't know that he essentially, you know, is one of the three guys who almost founded the religious freedom legal movement. You know, the guy who literally founded Patrick Henry College, the homeschool legal defense Association, like the modern homeschooling movement. And he is just, you know, the most genuine. You know, we sat down for an interview at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, and he just, you know, yes, yes, that's true. He's that too. So it's like so many hats, but so, you know, down to earth, personable. He and I talked, we talked about how he's been demonized and yet how he has connected with people in some of the strangest ways. You know, he met a friend online doing online bridge playing. And this guy is very liberal, very democratic. And he would constantly just refer and act as though, you know, Republicans were like subhuman or something. But he was great friends with Mike Ferris. And Mike turns to him one day and says, do you realize that I'm a Republican? And he's like, you're not one of those people. And I think it's very interesting the sort of divisions we get in our country. But one
They're being manufactured, I think, is the point. And as we speak, actually, we're doing a webinar today of our Committee on the Present Danger China, Tyler. And it's about how the cultural Marxists, both domestic and those of the Chinese Communist Party, are explicitly seeking to manufacture those divisions. One example of which I think is this whole transgender campaign. It's highly divisive and corrosive, as you know. But the point is that the Southern Poverty Law Center has throughout, I think, basically its entire existence, there was a period when we basically appreciated, did some good work on the Ku Klux Klan. But ever since then, it has been all about dividing us and vilifying good patriotic people. I'd like to think myself included. You, no doubt as well. And certainly guys like Michael Ferris, who, among other things, ran the Alliance for Defending Freedom for 5 years, a very important frontline legal defense operation, basically, for our constitutional rights. And the SPLC has talked about them as haters and bigots, I think, and everything else. So talk a little bit about the state of the SPLC. I know that it has had some shall we say, unpleasant revelations by you, among others, over the years. I think of it as a completely discredited organization, but how is it that it persists and nonetheless is used by the New York Times and Washington Post and others to slander, really, so many of us?
The SPLC has actually gotten its tentacles into the Biden administration in many different parts of the Biden administration, too. So, you know, this is an organization, when I wrote the book in 2020, you know, it was reeling after the sexual harassment and racial discrimination scandal that led the SPLC to fire its co-founder, Morris Dees. And then,
wait a minute, let's pause on that. This was an organization that is supposed to be the watchdog against all of this kind of stuff, and it was practicing at home?
Yes. Yeah, so this is a watchdog meant to be enforcing hate, saying like, if there's a hate group in America, we're going to call you out. And there at the SPLC, they were not, you know, they were not promoting their black staffers. There were women who were being sexually harassed by various different leadership at the SPLC. I mean, Richard Cohen, the longtime president, also resigned in the midst of this scandal. And of course, what we had then was one of the former staff coming out and writing this very important tell-all essay from which the title of my book came, Making Hate Pay. He said, you know, until justice rains down like dollars, because he said that the SPLC was all about manufacturing hate to increase donations, to scare those rich Northern liberals so much that there's so much hatred and bigotry in the South that we're calling out, send us your money and we will protect you from this hatred. Meanwhile, the SPLC is raking in the cash.
Yeah, let me ask you about this, though. Of course, it wasn't just Northern liberals they were getting money from. It was all over the country, and it wasn't just Southern haters that they were going after. It was people all over the country. And when you say manufacturing hate, I think what you're getting at Tyler, and it's an apt way of describing it, is manufacturing groups they say are engaged in hate mongering. You know, our Center for Security Policy, for example, was, you know, terrifically libeled or slandered or both on the grounds that we were studying, researching, documenting, you know, the threat we face from what we call Sharia supremacists, jihadists. And the Muslim Brotherhood didn't like it a bit, of course, because we were exposing what they were doing. And their friends in the SPLC were turned on to try to shut us down. I would like to think we were canceled before canceled was a thing. But I'd like to just say to our audience, one of the reasons why I'm so proud of the work we do at the Center for Security Policy is that not only wasn't it hate, it was telling the truth in a space in which the government generally wasn't and is so urgently needed, as we'll be talking about with Jonathan Tobin in a moment. These are people, not all Muslims, to be clear, but the Sharia supremacist ones, particularly those associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, who want to tear us down, destroy America. And they're hard at it, as are their Shia counterparts out of Iran. So, Tyler, when you look at the people that are being attacked, pilloried, vilified, slandered, whatever term you want to use, by the SPLC, to raise money, I mean, a huge amount of money for that matter. Give us the latest estimates on what they've got in the bank.
Yeah, they've got an endowment of $730 million.
Unbelievable.
More than $500 million.
Unbelievable.
And of course, thousands in Cayman Island accounts, which for a nonprofit, like, why do you have money in the Cayman Islands? But
right,
you know,
and why do you have that kind of money, period? But obviously this has been a huge grifting operation. But to the point, you know, there have been people who have sued the SPLC. And I gather when we last talked, there had been some progress in connection with a suit. Talk about where that stands at the moment, if anywhere.
Yeah, so there is a suit working its way through the discovery process right now. Actually, in about a month's time, there's going to be another development on that, in that very important case. That's the case of the Dustin Inman Society that got branded a hate group. I mean, it's like a tailor-made defamation case, because the Dustin Inman Society had existed before the SPLC had said that this was not a hate group. And then years later, the SPLC registered a lobbyist to lobby against a bill the Dustin Inman Society supported, and at the same time said, now you're a hate group. So there are all sorts of
levels.
I'm
sure that was purely coincidental, don't you think?
Purely an accident.
Comrade.
No, yeah, the timeline doesn't make any impact at all. Yeah. But yeah, so.
But thank God they've gotten into discovery. And if this is, you know, burrowing into what the SPLC has been forced to cough up in terms of evidence, I look forward in the month's time to finding out what is in it. And I know you'll be reporting on it, Tyler. But just to conclude on this, for those who want to learn more about the SPLC, obviously we commend them to your book, Making Hate Pay. Obviously, we also commend them to the Center for Security Policy site, and hope, as always, that they will consider contributing to what we do in the way of research. What other resources would you recommend for people who want to know more about this and to counteract, hopefully, the damage that the SPLC does?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would also recommend the Daily Signal, dailysignal.com. I would be remiss not to mention Heritage, but also, you know, there's Alliance Defending Freedom, as you mentioned earlier. You know, Mike Ferris was president there for 5 years. They have good
and
resources.
Not least the Family Research Council, which was attacked by somebody inspired to go on a murderous shooting rampage by, wait for it, the Southern Poverty Law Center. Tyler O'Neill, thank you so much for the work you do day in and day out at the Daily Signal. We look forward to working with you on this and so many other projects of mutual interest. God bless you, my friend. And I know you'll report back when you have some more evidence of the SPLC's misdeeds.
Thanks,
we'll be right back with
always
more.
A pleasure.
I hope the rest of you will stay tuned. We'll be talking about Israel. We'll be talking about the threat from those same jihadis here in the United States with Jonathan Tobin next.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, President Biden and Secretary of State Tony Blinken threatened that if Israel does not change its operations in Gaza, U.S. policy towards supporting the Jewish state will change. Translation, unless Benjamin Netanyahu's government saves Hamas, America will no longer supply the weapons required to defeat it. The Biden administration is also reportedly conducting a four-pronged campaign to overthrow the Israeli government. What is now in distinct prospect is an American-driven defeat of an allied nation that will make Team Biden's betrayal and destruction of Afghanistan pale by comparison. While the Israelis are hoping to secure further U.S. help with expanded humanitarian assistance that principally props up Hamas, their enemies and ours, now foresee that they will surely be able eventually, if not soon, to drive the Jews from the river to the sea. Biden's Afghanistan 2.0 must be repudiated now. This is Frank Affney.
Back, and what a delight to be able to say welcome to our next guest. His name is Jonathan Tobin. He is the editor-in-chief of wonderful service in Israel, but it really serves the world. It's called the Jewish News Syndicate. He splits his time between the States and Israel. I'm not quite sure where we've caught up with him at the moment, but we're delighted to catch him wherever we are. He is a columnist, among other things, for Newsweek. He is a very formidable intellect, as well as, analyst of what's happening at the moment in Israel, yes, and also what it means for all of us. Jonathan, welcome back. It's good to have you with us here at Securing America.
Thanks so much, Frank. It's great to be with you.
Let me start by asking you, we're, as we speak, anticipating later this, today, I guess, this afternoon, I think, President Biden speaking with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and it's widely forecast that he will be, haranguing him about the tragic loss of life among seven assistance workers in Gaza, humanitarian assistance, that is, and probably raking him over the coals over the idea that Israel feels it must go into Rafah to take down the last of Hamas. Give us your anticipated reporting on what's coming out of this meeting.
Yeah, unfortunately, as you say, the tragic accident in which some aid workers were killed, that fits right into Biden's narrative that Israel is committing indiscriminate bombing, killing too many people, and that there's no way that the war should continue because too many people are being killed and everybody in Gaza is starving. And this is the justification for, you know, American policy, America building a pier off of Gaza with the help of Qatar, of all countries, and Qatar insisting on using a Hamas construction company to help with it. We understand from an American point of view, this is about American politics. This is about Biden bowing the knee to his left wing. He believes he has to stop the war in order to win the election, which, you know, from an American point of view is crazy. He's not losing. If he is losing to Donald Trump, he's losing because of his terrible policies on immigration and his economic failures, not because he's insufficiently hostile to Israel. I believe there are far more votes in the center to be lost by being anti-Israel than on the left for being insufficiently anti-Israel. But the whole point is that he wants to pressure Israel to stop fighting, let Hamas win. And he thinks Netanyahu is vulnerable and weak because Netanyahu is under fire. He's a controversial figure. He's been in power, you know, forever. He has a lot of people, domestic opposition. But what I think Biden continues to ignore is the fact that as controversial and as unpopular in among sort of the half of the country that doesn't like him, that Netanyahu is, his policies are popular. There's overwhelming support in Israel for continuing the war. And indeed, any Israeli prime minister, even if it was one of Netanyahu's opponents, would continue fighting the war to destroy Hamas.
This is a key point.
Would be allowed to get away with it. That would be an unforgivable sin to the Israeli public, to let their security to be endangered. Remember, this is something that is not reported in the American press. There are hundreds of thousands of Israelis who are still displaced from their homes in southern Israel, as well as northern Israel. They can't go home until this war is over because it's not safe. You know, hundreds of thousands of refugees are living in hotels in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and other parts of the country, in the central parts of the country, because of what happened on October 7th and the war that followed.
Right. Let me just get a word in here. That's a function not simply of the war that is now dragging out, I believe, because mostly of U.S. meddling vis-a-vis Hamas. As you say, I think aimed at saving Hamas. But it's also a function of what Hezbollah in the north is doing and seeks to do going forward. Jonathan, there's some reporting that, you know, the Iranians, in response to a strike that most people believe Israel quite successfully conducted against a building in a diplomatic compound in which there were seven, I believe, top terrorists from Iran, that the Iranians are now making noises about retaliation directly from Iran, no less, against Israel. This is part of the Biden incantation as well. We've got to prevent any kind of widening of the war. How wide is the war now, as you see it, sir?
Well, the war exists in the north. As I said, Israeli communities along the northern border have been emptied out because of Hezbollah firing into them. It's not safe there. That said, Hezbollah did not join the war with, you know, jump in with a full effort after October 7th. They still are not doing so. And as much as Iran is sort of beating its chest, rattling its sabers, and indeed Israel is on alert because about the possibility, I think it is highly unlikely that they will really start a full-fledged conflagration with Israel over this, any more than they've done so when America struck at Iranian terrorists under Donald Trump. Hezbollah, remember, is Iran's, you know, ace in the hole. It's their fail-safe. They are holding it back with their hundreds of thousands of missiles and ability to really inflict pain on Israel in case Iran is directly attacked against their nuclear program if the regime is threatened. They will not risk that over a few terrorists.
Yeah, I agree. Jonathan, let me quickly ask you about this pier. I personally believe this is a terrible mistake, both for Israel and for the United States. I think there's a chance that it could be stopped, but it requires the Israeli government to make it clear that it's not happy with this idea. To date, that's not been the position of the Israeli government. Is that just because they don't want another fight with the United States, or are they actually okay with the idea of having a vehicle that they don't control used to channel more stuff, not necessarily humanitarian stuff?
They're not okay with it. Nobody in Israel is okay with it. But how many fronts are you going to fight with Biden? Remember, I mean, you know, Israel is dependent on the United States for arms and resupply.
Hold the thought, Jonathan. We have to take a short break. I apologize. We'll be right back with more with Jonathan Tobin right after this. Welcome back. Jonathan Tobin is with us, a columnist for Newsweek, among other outlets here in the United States, also the editor-in-chief of a tremendously important service in Israel, the Jewish News Syndicate. We always appreciate its visits, especially at a time such as this. And Jonathan, I interrupted you, unfortunately, because we're out of time, but finish your thought on this idea of a port. I personally believe that this is just the latest evidence of America's, under Biden, betrayal of Israel. And I think it should be treated as such, both here and there.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. It's a terrible idea on so many levels. You know, to sort of replay D-Day, you know, Mulberry Harbor off of Gaza, and the idea that no Americans will ever touch the shore of Gaza while doing it. It's completely magical thinking.
Or be touched by Hamas.
Or be touched by Hamas. There. The idea that the supplies that it brings in will have nothing to do with Hamas is insane. You know, the construction company that Qatar wants to do this is the same construction company that builds all of Hamas's stuff, the tunnels, you know, the New York subway system under Gaza. So it's complete nonsense. Now, as to why Israel isn't, you know, drawing a line in the sand over it, remember, Israel is still completely dependent on the United States for arms. The United States has encouraged that complete dependence over the years. And in order to get the resupply of Iron Dome, you know, missiles and just, you know, artillery and all that, they need to, you know, the one thing that Biden hasn't done, or at least hasn't done completely, is cut off the flow of arms to Israel. You know, Israel needs ammunition to keep fighting. It will continue, it will go into Rafah sooner or later, whether Biden likes it or not, but they do not wish to escalate that confrontation or, you know, bring it on sooner than it has to be brought on. So they'll probably lay down over this, as crazy and as dangerous. It's dangerous for America also. It's an American involvement in a war in which Israel doesn't want them, and in which Americans can only be in danger by this. The idea that no Americans will be hurt by, you know, building, you know, a supply line for Hamas, you know, is basically insane.
Another consideration, again, from American point of view, Biden administration, as you probably know, Jonathan, has been bringing hundreds of thousands of people into the United States surreptitiously by air. My guess is there will be an outflow of jihadis from the Gaza Strip at some point via this same channel, and suddenly they'll be turning up in our cities as well. Which brings me to a topic that I wanted to visit with you about. I think we've got a video clip that I'd like my colleague Justin to play as we speak. In Times Square, and you've spent a lot of time, I think you're originally from New York City, in that area. Justin, we had, let's go to the video here. We had something that's not unprecedented by any means. We've seen a lot of it in Europe, as a matter of fact, with the, you know, the folks who are of a certain, shall we say, Sharia supremacist mindset, pouring into the streets, usually outside of a mosque, taking them over. And they're engaging in essentially their prayers, but also of a very profoundly ominous threat, it seems to me, especially when you look at the demographics of it. Let's go to the video as you respond, sir.
Well, I will just say this, Frank. We have seen this over the last several months, evidence of the pro-Hamas mobs, you know, evidence of this sort of bizarre red-green alliance of Islamists and radical leftists who have, you know, taken over the public square in many of America's cities, certainly New York. They blocked bridges and tunnels. We've seen them on college campuses. And quite frankly, we've also seen them outside of our main cities demonstrating and blockading synagogues, harassing. It's part of this horrible surge of anti-Semitism in the United States since October 7th that has been encouraged by the left and is being driven by the left and their hatred for Israel and the Jews. It's part of their whole critical race theory, intersectional lies, and it endangers not just American Jews. It endangers American democracy and liberty. These are people who are a security threat. We don't know how many of them are legal immigrants or not. And they are basically not merely calling for the destruction of Israel, as they do, and the genocide of the Jewish people. They hate America. They are a fifth column within our borders.
And Jonathan, this is such a critically important point. There is, unfortunately, in addition to the numbers of, as we see, young men of fighting age present in this country, but there's an entire infrastructure that has been built out over the past few decades, going back to, I think, the early 1960s, by the Muslim Brotherhood. Their mosque complexes, their Islamic centers, what have you. And I really worry about this influx of foreign jihadis marrying up with that infrastructure to pose, as you say, a very real threat. The point being, Israel is not simply fighting her enemies in taking these guys on, Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, the Houthi rebels, what have you. She's fighting ours as well. And they're here, and they're likely to cause us great harm in due course.
You know, to imagine that all of these, you know, people who hate America and who whose numbers have been swelled by Biden's open borders policies, that they are in no way a security threat, is again, it's magical thinking to think that there is no danger here. And quite frankly, since our security services and police departments have been told to stand down, they're not allowed to really surveil them anymore because that's considered discrimination or Islamophobia. And of course, most of the things that are labeled Islamophobia are just calling out, you know, radical Muslims for their hatred of America and hatred of Jews. And so, yes, Israel is, in fighting Hamas, Israel is fighting the war that ultimately threatens all Americans here at home as well as any place else.
Yeah. And, you know, this whole notion of Islamophobia, of course, is it's meant to conjure up this idea of an unreasoned fear of people who make no bones, as you say, of their intent to kill you. That's not an unreasoned fear. That is just common sense. Magical thinking is a very generous term for it. I think delusional at best, and at worst, it's highly deceptive and leading us to great, great peril. I want to say this is a very prime focus of our Center for Security Policy. We've addressed it massively over the years. I encourage you to learn more there at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. And while you're there, support our efforts if you would. Jonathan Tobin, we have to leave it at that. God bless you, my friend. Keep up the great work and come back to us again soon.
Thanks so much for having me on, Frank, and keep up your great work.
Thank you. Go forth and multiply.